This is the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast.
Good Monday morning, everybody. Glad you're with us. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN News, Sirius XM Channel 80, and your smart speakers. We are presented by Progressive Insurance. All phone guests join us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Mike Golic Jr., Trey Wingo here with you. We got a lot to get to today because it was a very busy weekend, and we had a very busy pre-show meeting doing all kinds of interesting research.
Yes, we did. And what's interesting, this is the last week of Golic and Wingo, and we're doing our last show on Friday. And I wonder if baseball will make it that far the way it's going right now. I mean, we've got live sports finally to talk about in a few different sports. But boy, there is some trepidation along the ways with positive tests and injuries going on.
Yeah, it is. It is the excitement of opening day that came last week, and I think just the general, oh wow, this feels good of seeing live sports back in a bunch of different fashions this weekend. We have the WNBA back this season, tipping off on Saturday, Premier Lacrosse, all this stuff, and it is slowly being replaced by the sinking dread that is looking out at the one non-bubble sport and going, okay, this is going about as poorly as you could have unfortunately imagined at the beginning.
Correct. And we'll get to that part of it in a second. But there's another part of what's going on in baseball that is just, it makes you wonder if we gave people enough ramp-up time. Because one thing we learned over the first weekend of Major League Baseball, pitchers are going down and going down in bunches.
Well, you know, we've talked about this a lot. And, you know, we'd get people to come on and say, well, you know, these are pro athletes, don't know how to take care of themselves. And because we asked this in every sport. We always said, what's going to be that injury? What's it going to be in basketball? What's it going to be in baseball? What's it going to be in football coming up, which we'll get to. And, oh, boy, has it hit in baseball, starting from opening night when Clayton Kershaw was scratched with a stiff back last Thursday. He tweaked it last Tuesday and ended up not starting on Thursday. Now we go with Steven Strasburg. He misses his start with a hand.
A nerve issue in his hand.
We have Corey Kluber for the Rangers.
He threw one inning,
and he has a tight shoulder. You have Shohei Ohtani. It wasn't an injury, but he's coming back from an injury. Absolutely getting shelled.
Record a single out.
Not one in 30 pitches. Then you have Justin Verlander, who threw six innings, who actually threw in the game, did pretty well throwing in the game, and then afterward had the stiff forearm, and there were reports at first that he might be out for the season. Doesn't look like it's
going to be. I was going to say, we were sitting together yesterday, and the way different apps and different outlets will send out a push notification, when a story comes out, it was Justin Verlander out for the year at first with an elbow injury, and then obviously everyone's come out since then, Dusty Baker and others, you know, refuting those reports, saying that it's a forearm injury, saying they're just shutting him down right now as a precaution.
Right. It was a Houston Chronicle article. Justin Verlander said that's not accurate. I'm going to give it a little rest. And then obviously Dusty Baker was asked about it. Here was Dusty after the game.
You know, we know it's a forearm strain, and he's being seen by the doctor, so he'll probably be shut down for a couple of weeks, and then we'll see from there.
Will he pitch for you this season?
Well, like I said, I just said he shut down for a couple of weeks, and then we'll, reevaluate it from there. We don't know.
When did it happen?
It happened yesterday, early in the game, but he said he felt, he felt fine. And you see he was throwing the ball great yesterday, and it was kind of a shock to all of us.
That's the thing about it. He was throwing the ball well, go six innings, not like Kluber comes out after the first inning, or Kershaw that never makes it there, or Strasburger never makes it to his start. This had to be a stunner. And then initially to think, oh my God, the season, which of course is just a couple of months this year, but even you're talking 2 weeks, just maybe 2 weeks, maybe on the short side of possibly 2 weeks. As we said, any injury that goes, for 2 weeks to a month or so, I mean, you get to a month, you're talking half the season. Now you're talking a team that's got a great shot, obviously, at the postseason, but I mean, all this stuff, and when it heals, because you don't know about Kluber in the shoulder, we don't know about Kershaw in the back, we don't know about Strasburg in the hand, and we don't know about Verlander and his forearm. So, I mean, this is what a horror, forgetting even the virus, which we'll get to.
Right.
I mean, these are some top pitchers already right out of the gate.
Well, the other thing, too, Verlander has just been a workhorse. I mean, there's a lot of innings in that arm. No one has thrown more pitches, innings, or faced more batters than Verlander since he debuted in 2005. over almost 49,000 pitches, over 12,000 batters faced, and almost 3,000 innings pitched. So we're talking about someone who has had a lot of stress on that. And you hear forearm stiffness, and you think, oh, okay, well, it's just something here. That's not always the way. You know, you talk about it when you have an injury in your knee. Sometimes you're compensating with different things, and your hammy goes and all that kind of stuff. Well, Jeff Passan breaks down exactly what this means when you hear someone who's had that kind of durability and that kind of pitching stamina over all these years, and what forearm stiffness really might mean instead of just the forearm.
Anytime you hear the words forearm strain, it goes right back to the elbow, because the muscles that are in the forearm, the flexor pronator and three other muscles in there, are connected to the elbow ligaments, and well, those things tend not to go well when you have a forearm strain. Now, that being said, a forearm strain itself does not mean that Justin Verlander is going to need Tommy John surgery or that he's going to need surgery at all. Typically, they'll give it a couple of weeks rest to see what the elbow looks like and what the muscles in the forearm look like, and then reassess there whether it's prophylactic treatment like a platelet-rich plasma injection or stem cells or something along those lines. You gotta wait and see how the injury heals over these next couple of weeks before you figure out how to treat it and what the course of action is.
So in other words, when just understand that it could be something much more significant. We don't know for sure yet, but for someone that's worked that many innings at the age of 37, it's obviously not something that is very promising at this
point. Yeah, there are major concerns associated with it. And like Dad said, all of this goes back to the idea that you have disrupted their normal routine with this stuff. And even being pros, and that's always the difference that we've said, is in the professional ranks, you can expect, because of the salaries and because of the way this is structured, them to go about and operate with their best interest and the league's best interest in mind in a way that college players, it's harder to legislate with. This is troubling. Like, this is part one of the two-part baseball, oh my God, thing that we're going to do to start the show here, which is you're having the worst version of this, which is injury being a result of what we'd imagined the shortened ramp up to this season.
Oh, without question. And then these are obviously, you talk about guys like Strasburg, like Clayton Kluber. Kershaw and Verlander, really, depending on what Texas does, teams that are looking at the postseason. Yes. Now, it is expanded, so we'll see. But, I mean, teams that are expected to not only be in the postseason, but do damage in the postseason. I mean, you want to really talk about taking, you know, where's that line of making sure they're ready for the postseason and making sure with 16 teams you're probably going to make the postseason. It's over half the teams getting in, and not matter where you are, just get to it and make sure they're right, provided they can come back, because you're already talking about missing a few more starts.
Yeah, and I guess that's the tough part, is baseball's long season used to be the advantage for stuff like this. Is all right, you could afford to be overly cautious in these situations to say we're just going to get this right. It's the course of a long season. It is a 60-game sprint now, and so it's going to stress all of the parts in this situation. And for these guys, does the thing in the back of your mind start to rattle around and say, for this shortened season, am I really going to go out there and tax this in the way that's going to be asked of me, coming off of being shut down like Verlander, being put on ice for that first start like Kershaw? Like, am I willing to potentially throw myself into a more severe injury for a championship that's already going to be a crapshoot over this shortened season?
You know, understand too, we're already in the part of the season that's past the All-Star break from the normal season. So anybody that gets that long-term injury now, they're into next year.
Correct.
You know, they're into the, if everything goes right next year and you start everything on time, you are already at that point.
Right. And so these are all problematic, as you said, in a 60-game season. But then there's the reason we're having a 60-game season. And that is also rearing its ugly head in Major League Baseball. And we'll get to that next. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN2.
Golic
and Wingo.
And Wingo.
Mm-hmm. Trey Wingo and Mike Golic Sr. Mike Tannenbaum joins us now. So, Mike, you are now the New York Jets. You are now the general manager. You are now Joe Douglas. And you have sent away your best player, arguably, in Jamal Adams. But in return, you get a starter that's going to take his place in Bradley McDougal, a first-round pick in 2021 and 2022, and a third-round pick in 2021, and you give up Adams and a fourth-round pick. If you're Joe Douglas, that's a pretty good deal, don't you think?
I think it's a pretty good deal, and I'm happy about the flexibility I have moving forward, guys. I actually have a pretty underrated safety situation, because you mentioned McDougal, they have Marcus May, and they drafted a really intriguing player in Ashton Davis from the University of California. So,
correct.
From an actually on-the-field standpoint, I like that. Here are my two concerns. first of all, these are probably going to be lower round picks. And when you think about first round picks, that is, if you think about some of their recent sort of Seattle where they've picked, they've added Rashad Penny, LJ Collier, Afedi, certainly guys that have had mixed results at best. So there's no certainty, you know, barring something unforeseen, because they have Russell Wilson, we're not talking about top 10 picks. And the other fundamental concern I would have, guys, is a tremendous intangibles. And I've had the privilege of both sitting in the seat in Miami and New York, which is when a player finds a pathway to get out of a situation, and that situation would be due to play time, money, doesn't like a coach, and they can kick and scream their way out, which is what Jamal Adams just did, they have now created a blueprint. And you just hope, if I'm Joe Douglas, that I don't open up Pandora's box here and start a terrible precedent.
And, oh, by the way, their precedent of their first-round draft picks haven't been great as of late either. So
Jamal was the best. Yeah,
it's exactly right. All right, how about on the Seattle side of it?
Yeah, I really like it from a scheme standpoint. When we think about those great Seattle defenses, guys, Cam Chancellor, Earl Thomas, they're going to play to Jamal Adams' strength, which is close to the line of scrimmage. He's very productive as a blitzer, over 10 career sacks as a safety, which is really rare, so I like it. However, I think they made a huge mistake over the weekend, which is it's the next example of a team giving up multiple first-round picks and not agreeing to an extension. So when the Houston Texans traded for Laremy Tunsil with the Miami Dolphins and gave up two first-round picks and didn't sign him to an extension, it literally cost them $4 to $5 million a year when they did sign Tunsil. The Rams gave Jalen Ramsey a blank check. They gave up two first-round picks to the Jaguars, no extension. You're giving players massive amounts of leverage. And when we think about the highest-paid safety in Eddie Jackson at $14.6 million a year, Jamal Adams will laugh at that number. So I like it for a number of reasons for Seattle, certainly short-term, but there's going to be a massive contract at some point.
Mike Tannenbaum with us here on Golic and Wingo. Mike, looking back at the Jet side of things here, I mean, would it have been any less destructive to what the Jets are doing there to keep a guy who was clearly that disgruntled, who had said the things he did about your coach and front office around, as opposed to trying to maximize value for him?
You know, Mike, that's a totally fair point. And I guess, unfortunately, I can answer this question with a rare amount of expertise. I sat in that seat. I had Darrell Revis hold out. He was really upset with me and the fact that we weren't giving him an extension. And I always just try to make it about the facts and work really, really hard to get a solution. And it was tough for Joe Douglas, candidly, because, you know, Joe inherited Jamal Adams. He didn't draft him. There wasn't, you know, some sort of foundation of a relationship. And I understand why they did it. And again, I think where Joe Douglas deserves a ton of credit is he maximized the value of the player, despite the fact that everybody knew he didn't want to be there, which is hard to do. So I can understand why they did it. And again, they'll be okay at safety. But if you just walk around saying, hey, we just got to get rid of any headache today and not work hard to solve problems, it's just my concern for them is you just hope this is not the last time this happens.
Mike Tannenbaum with us, our NFL front office insider. So before we move on to the litany of other things we need to talk about in the NFL, how important now is it for this Jets power duo of Joe Douglas and Adam Gase to make sure that they continue the success they had at the end of last season when Sam Darnold came back and they won a bunch of games? Because you're right, people will gripe and they'll say, look what happened here, we lost our best player, and people are upset about it. But you know what cures all of that? Winning. How important is it for Douglas and Gase to make sure the Jets get off to a good start now?
Yeah, and in this case, winning is number one, but I would say 1A is the trajectory of Sam Darnold's career, because let's face it, if they go 7-9 and Sam Darnold throws for 5,000 yards and, you know, 40 touchdowns and two interceptions, I think things will look great. Likewise, if they go 9-7 and Sam Darnold's bench, you know, that could be a different conversation. So I think when they hired Adam Gase, someone I had a chance to work with in Miami, it was clear it was to develop Sam Darnold. So I think it's consequential how well he plays for the future of that program. And I think they've done a nice job of addressing the offensive line, trying to get more weapons. I think Chris Herndon coming back is very underrated. So I think that offense has a chance to be much better than last year, where just through injury and illnesses, they had a revolving door at quarterback. And if they could at least establish Darnold as a good NFL starter, I think that will go a long way to calming down the noise.
Mike, let me throw this one at you here. I kind of thought about this as I saw Jamal going to Seattle on that secondary. We know what that secondary was. And we know that Pete Carroll, for those maybe that don't, Pete Carroll has been a secondary coach before he was a defensive coordinator, before he was a head coach. And that legion of boom, now Earl Thomas was a first-rounder, but Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor were fifth-round picks. Byron Maxwell was a sixth-rounder. Brandon Browner was undrafted. So I guess my point is they find ways to not have to pay big money and had excellent guys on defense. You're going to have to make this guy by far the highest-paid safety in the league. Did you need to do that with the way that Pete Carroll can coach that defense and that secondary?
Yeah, Mike, I think it's a really fair point, but here's the going behind the curtain. Here's the conversation they're having. Hey, we got to beat San Francisco. It's really close. There is no way in the world, based on where we've been drafting, that we would get a player anywhere close to Jamal Adams, and we're going to have to pay a big premium. But if he could go cover George Kittle, if he could, you know, help slow down that 49er offense, it's worth it. And we have to continue to draft and develop, you know, some other guys. And some of their players back there, you know, that's certainly going to be the case. They're not all first-rounders. Like Marquise Blair was a second-rounder. Trey Flowers was a fifth-rounder. Your point is well taken, but I think Jamal Adams is looked upon much more as just a playmaker because he really is an unusual player. You could almost say he's a little bit of a linebacker. So their draft and development in the lower rounds has been a huge, huge part of their success, especially given, you know, how much Russell Wilson now makes.
Mike, I'm curious from a big picture sense in the NFL now, as we look at a lot of the things that were agreed upon over the weekend between the league and the players, how concerned are you looking at what's happening in baseball right now, the other major sport that's not going to exist in a bubble?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, you think about the privileges of these jobs, and now you're worrying about, like, where your players are eating and, you know, can they order food from certain establishments or not? And I thought the rules that the league and the union came up with over the weekend made a ton of sense. Like, we're all trying to get the right result in a weird situation and trying to make sure players don't go to certain establishments. It makes a ton of sense. And I think what we saw in baseball going on with the Marlins, for example, it's going to happen. We've talked about this a lot. People are going to test positive. And I've heard from a number of teams that they're going to have practices where it's going to be their second play caller. Their head coach won't go to practice for a day just so they could get used to different situations. And I think over the next few months, guys, the narrative is going to be like, wow, you know, Matt Ryan's out for Atlanta or Carson Wentz is out for Philadelphia. And we're just going to see weird and unusual things happen. And I think it's going to be in football with coaches as well. Just it's the reality of the situation. And we're going to learn a lot. And it's going to be a very unusual year, I think, on a lot of different levels.
Well, unusual might be the nicest way to put what we may be seeing. And then there's, Mike, the practicality of what we're talking about. Look, we're all doing this, and the NFL's doing everything they can to make sure they get to week one and start the season with that Thursday night game between the Chiefs and the Texans with the COVID situation. But then we're only talking about, what, 14 padded practices before we start the season for just the idea of getting people ready to play football. Is that enough?
No, and when you think about who's going to be successful or not, it's going to be continuity, continuity, and continuity. You know, when you think about the teams that are returning their quarterback, their play caller, it's just a massive advantage. And let's look at the NFC East guys. You know, you talk about guys like Joe Judge. He's never been a head coach before, and now all of a sudden, you know, Daniel Jones has never taken a snap with him. You don't know protections or ways that certain nuances of your offense are going to run. And it's going to take a while. And you think about Washington and Dallas, all those teams will have growing pains. Now, you could say with Dallas, well, they're going to be returning Kellen Moore, but they still have a new head coach in Mike McCarthy. He's never been in a meeting physically with Dak Prescott. That's unbelievable. So you think about that division, Philadelphia is light years ahead of those other three teams from a continuity standpoint. So especially early on, I think the teams with those advantages will have a huge, huge advantage over those teams that are going to be truly learning on the fly.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be something, and we'll see how it goes.
Yep.
I mean, that's all we can say at this point. Yep. Mike, we appreciate your time this morning. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Golic.
I tell you what, a great sports night last night, yeah. No doubt about it.
And Wingo.
What a day, what a show, what a time.
One, two, three, four.
Kendrick Perkins is now with us this morning. Kendrick, how are you right now?
I'm doing well. How y'all doing?
We're doing good. We're doing good. We're trying to figure out if Lou Williams is being penalized because he went to Magic City, and is that fair?
Yes, it's fair. I mean, listen, Lou has to be more responsible. You're looking at a guy that's, you know, a 15, 16-year vet, you know, and during this pandemic time and then, you know, leaving the bubble. You know, I understand he had a family emergency, but he has to be more responsible. I get it, you know, going to Magic City for the wings or whatever, although I think he went for the legs and thighs. But at the end of the day, you have a young guy like Zion Williamson who left for a family emergency, and he handled it more maturely than Lou will. We didn't hear anything from Zion. He went and took care of his business, and now he's back to the bubble. Well, here it is. You see Lou Will in Magic City, and it's kind of disturbing because the NBA has did a great job going forward as far as dealing with the pandemic, getting this bubble together. And they tested zero cases out of 362 people. And now Lou going to Magic City and then trying to come back to the bubble is putting everybody at a high risk. So he should be penalized. He should have to quarantine for 2 weeks to make sure that everyone is safe because it was just irresponsible on his part.
Well, let me play devil's advocate, Kendrick. And do we know that Zion didn't go out to dinner anywhere? I forget Magic City, just to dinner in a restaurant where there were other people. And if... take Magic City, we know what it is, but if Magic City is following the code and has the amount of right the people that they're supposed to have in there, if they're following the local laws, what's the difference? What's the difference if somebody leaves the bubble and goes out to dinner or goes to Magic City as long as they're following the local rules?
Well, here's the thing. You mean to tell me that Zion Williamson, who's one of the most popular basketball players in the world, if he goes out to dinner, I'm pretty sure he can't be discreet about it. Like someone, they have so many people that's able to, that got cell phones that probably would have recorded him. And then again, he didn't get caught. So at the end of the day, Lou Will got caught. And then to make it even worse, it was at Magic City. Just think about it. That's not like a typical dinner. We talking about Magic City. We talking about, you know, a place with, you know, a lot of, you know, interaction going on. So at the end of the day, I think that's a whole different scenario.
Talking to Kendrick Perkins with us. Thank you for using interaction on FCC regulated radio with us, Perk. We greatly appreciate your professionalism in that regard and saving us from ourselves here. So that is going to be one scenario that the Clippers are going to have to deal with, and that roster is already dealing with missing some guys and missing some bodies potentially in all this. But we did get some news yesterday about a team that's not in the bubble, Perk. It seems the Knicks are zeroing in on and getting ready to finalize a deal with Tom Thibodeau to be their next head coach there. You played, obviously, under a team with Thibs on the staff in Boston. I'm curious, how do you see the fit working with him in an organization like the Knicks?
Well, listen, the Knicks were at rock bottom, right? So the only way they could go is up. And in my opinion, when you look at Tom Thibodeau, he's the true definition of what? Culture. And that's what the Knicks have been lacking. Yes, you know, Tibbs is going to bring that winning mentality, and I get it. Everyone is saying, you know, Tibbs has a history of running young guys into the ground, and, you know, sometimes he overworked guys or whatever. But, you know, Tibbs has been out the game for, you know, about a year and a half, 2 years. So he's had time to evaluate himself. He's had time to look himself in the mirror. And Tibbs is a smart guy. So he's going to make the adjustments that need be. But with that being said, Tibbs is a guy that he don't take any shortcuts. He's there at 5 in the morning. And the way that Tibbs carry himself, he holds everyone accountable by his actions, even the front office people, because of the way that he punches in the clock. So in my opinion, I think it was a great hire for them because that's the one thing that they need is a foundation and culture, and I think Tibbs is the right guy for that.
Well, listen, they've been looking for the right guy for a long time in New York, and hopefully this will get them going on a positive trajectory. They're not inside the bubble. As for the teams inside the bubble, what are you hearing from the people that are there and how they're handling? I mean, Steven Adams came out and said it's not we're staying in a bloody resort, basically. We should be fine, but there's going to be a monotony that's going to sit in. The monotony and the malaise is going to be part of this process, especially when you're not playing games yet, full regular season games. What have you been hearing from players inside the bubble, how they're dealing with it?
Well, you know, guys to me have been, you know, they've been pretty satisfied and pretty pleased with the things that, you know, how the bubble been. I think Adam Silver and the NBA and the Players Association, along with Chris Paul and Michelle Roberts, has done a great job with putting together this, I call it a billion-dollar bubble. You look at it, they're trying to accommodate guys. They're listening to guys' ideas to make them feel comfortable. And in my opinion, from the outside looking in, just watching the scrimmages, guys, you know, are down there and they're focused. The scrimmages have been very competitive. You could tell guys are focused on playing basketball, and that's the real reason that they're down there. But listen, they just put a barbershop down there. Like, they got everything that you could imagine for these people. And it's probably one of the safest places in America to be right now. So I'm looking at guys, you know, they going fishing. And a lot of these guys stay in their room anyway and play NBA 2K and you don't want to play the video game so they can play with themselves on the game. So at the end of the day, I think it's going to work out just fine. And from the outside looking in at the scrimmages, guys are locked in and focused on what they're supposed to be, and that's basketball.
Kendrick Perkins joining us here on Golic and Wingo, and they're catching some nice bass out of those lakes as well. That's been really cool to watch. Hey, Kendrick, as far as the play, once it starts with the 8 regular season games left, if you're one of the top teams, how do you play your stars in these 8 games?
Well, you know, you walk a fine line because, you know, you have 8 games to get guys in game rhythm, to get chemistry going, to get guys – you know, back in game shape and their legs up under them. But at the same time, you look at a veteran team like the Lakers or even a veteran squad like the Los Angeles Clippers. You want to make sure you do a great job of managing guys' minutes, but at the same time, you want to make sure guys get the right repetition in for game time going into the postseason. And at the end of the day, you also want to make sure that you get other guys' minutes down the 14, 15, you know, 12 through 15 that's on the bench, because you just never know. You might need those guys. So this is a time where, you know, the coaches get paid a great salary, and they're going to have to really coach and make sure that they, you know, cross their T's and dot their I's as far as making sure their rotations are set, making sure that they play the guys the right amount of minutes and getting guys rest. So that's how I'm looking at it.
Kendrick Perkins with us here on Golic and Wingo. Perk, before we let you go, I wanted to double back to Tibbs for a second here, just because you mentioned foundation when talking about what he's going to be able to come in there and set New York, but we know where this eventually leads. Do you think he's going to be able to change enough to help make New York a place that free agents are going to want to come? Do you think NBA stars, knowing what you said about the reputation of Tom Thibodeau, are going to want to come and play for him eventually?
Well, here's the thing. I don't think they're going to land in any stars anytime soon. And if they do, it's not going to be because of Tibbs. It's going to be because of Wild World West. That's why he's there. You know, that name's, you know, William Wesley, his nickname, World Wide West, is, he had that nickname for a reason, because he have relationships and he with everyone. I'm talking about, you know, going outside of basketball. He's hanging with Jay-Z and Beyonce. He knows everyone. So he's going to be the guy that lure in, you know, free agents and or happen to make trades for stars. But I think the Knicks need to draft well. And they have they're going to probably have a lottery pick, probably the number one pick. And the guy for that is LaMelo Ball. So I think that they need to draft well, make sure that they put a great coaching staff behind Tibbs and a player development staff and build from there, and then try to attract stars.
Well, we'll see. They've been trying to attract stars for a while.
Right.
And the stars have been saying, I'm good. We'll go to Brooklyn instead. Perk, as always, we appreciate your time, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate y'all.
Golic
and Wingo.
It was all sort of one big giant jello mold.
Very interesting where that went.
NFL insider extraordinaire Field Minister Yates. Field, two number ones for a safety. Good idea or not?
You know, Trey, I like the idea of when we're evaluating a trade, who got the best player in the deal as the quote-unquote winner. But I do think it's really interesting how different the tenor has been in evaluating the Jamal Adams trade as compared to evaluating the Laremy Tunsil trade, for example. Because it's not the exact same deal. There are more parts involved in the Miami-Houston deal. But the basic trade of a star player for two firsts is the same. I love Jamal Adams as a player. Anybody who tells you they don't is either an angry Jets fan or a 49ers slash Cardinals slash Los Angeles Rams fan right now. But two first-round picks, and let's be clear, we project those first-round picks probably to be somewhere in the 20 to 28 range, maybe even 32 range. So two late first-round picks for a player that plays a position that, if you just look at the top of the market of safety, has not been valued at the same level as a pass rusher or a wide receiver, of course, a quarterback, a left tackle. The NFL has not quite valued a safety like it has some of these other spots on the roster. So I think it is a bold and audacious move by the Seahawks, but I also am okay with a team that has Russell Wilson as its quarterback, that has a very competitive, I would argue the most competitive division, doing something that dramatically increases their chances to win right away. And the Seahawks now have an identity defensively that I think was sort of cemented with the addition of Jamal Adams.
From a financial standpoint, Field, if they don't do a extension now and wait till next year, how much more does it cost them because of waiting?
Well, I do think it has a chance to cost them if he does exactly what he wants them to, or what they want him to do, right, Mike? It's like, you know, you've got the potential for him to be just an average player, which I don't think that's going to happen. He's a back-to-back first-team All-Pro. But if he continues to play on his current trajectory, then I do think next year we're talking about Jamal Adams resetting the safety market in a major way. But I think that's a problem that Seattle would be okay with having. It would sort of further justify the trade. And if we look at Seattle and their history in recent years, they have not been afraid of resetting the market for position-specific contracts. Quarterback, they recently did so with Russell Wilson until Patrick Mahomes went and got $500 million. They did so with Bobby Wagner, who surpassed C.J. Mosley for the highest paid inside linebacker in football. They have not been afraid to do that. So I do think that a year probably will end up in a more player-favorable deal versus a team-favorable deal. But if you're the Seahawks, that means that you've gotten what you wanted out of Jamal Adams. And maybe a year from now, we're talking about him as the first ever $16 million per year safety, or something that's well above where other guys like Kevin Byard and Tyrann Mathieu and the other elite safeties in the NFL are currently at.
Field Yates with us here on Golic and Wingo. Field, does this put them out of the market with their toxic relationship with their ex Jadeveon Clowney? Are they finally priced out of a point where Jadeveon Clowney could be wearing a Seahawks uniform in 2020?
I think if he does come back, it would have to be on a one-year deal. And it would have to be on Clowney saying to himself, I really do care about the chance to win. Because if we look at the economics going forward, if you're making a multi-year commitment to Jadeveon Clowney and you're Seattle, over the weekend we learned that the cap could drop as low as $175 million. No lower, but that's as low as it could go, which would be a $23.2 million drop from where it is this year. And if you look at recent trends, we've been seeing this cap increase somewhere around $10 to $12 million per season. So you already have Russell Wilson, who, again, is making second most money of any quarterback in football. Jamal Adams is going to need a new deal a year from right now. You've got other players that either are due for a raise or would be extension eligible a year from now. Chris Carson is an example of a guy who's going to be a free agent amongst other players. That I think if Clowney comes back, it would have to be a one-year arrangement, or most likely be a one-year arrangement, and probably an arrangement that is fairly team-friendly, which maybe that's what Clowney has boxed himself into right now anyways, given that it's July 27th and he hasn't yet signed with any team. And that's probably the case for a lot of these remaining free agents. And there is a very good list of free agents still available, but I think a lot of them are taking prove-it type deals, are taking flyers, or they're going somewhere where money matters and winning may not matter to them. They're taking the biggest check they can get, which, by the way, no issue with that. but it may be that they're going from a team that was competing at a high level annually to a team that has a chance to go 6-10 this year.
With that in mind, Field, looking at that list, and there's some interesting names out there, Everson Griffin surprises me. Why do you think he's still there?
I think a lot of the guys that are still at still available right now had hopes of a multi-year deal, maybe not at the top of the market, but certainly in a very respectable range at their position. So Everson Griffin is sitting there saying to himself, all right, so if, for example, you've got guys who are taking deals this offseason, we didn't see a ton of pass rushers get paid in free agency, but still, we're seeing guys as pass rushers making $15, $18, $20 million per year. I deserve that kind of money, don't I? If you look at my track record, you look at my production, you look at how I played this past season after, you know, obviously a very interesting and uncommon 2018, Everson Griffin bounced back in a major way this past season. It's probably his last bite at the apple. So I think that most of these players are simply waiting for a long-term deal that never arrives. And at this point, they're having to just sort of weigh themselves, all right, where am I going to go on probably a shorter-term arrangement, understanding that not only is it a shorter and probably less lucrative deal than I wanted, but also, like, how does COVID impact my life? Do I want to go somewhere that is different for me? Do I want to put, if you've got a family, do you want to potentially be away from your family for 5 months or however long your season lasts? So I think that the dynamics that players are dealing with right now are, I certainly hope, once in a lifetime. And along those lines, some of these free agents are going to have to probably take deals that they would have never imagined, say, January 1st of this past year.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly all that has changed. Field, as always, we appreciate the time. Thank you, sir.
Guys, you're the best. Talk to you soon.
Golic and Wingo.
Let's not expect too much. There's only one person out there that's expecting way too much out of this guy too early. We know who that is. It's his father.
Michael Kay joins us now from 98.7 ESPN in New York. Michael, what's the feeling like in New York today watching a guy who made as much noise on the way out as Jamal Adams did leave town?
Well, you know, it started to turn last week, especially when he took the shots at Douglas and Gase. Up to that point, I believe that fans were in favor of everything that Jamal was doing because after a third year, you have a right to demand a renegotiation of your contract, but there was always a feeling that he was a bit too heavy-handed about it. And when we did our Friday show, the general feeling, and I felt this way as well, just let him rot. I mean, if you trade the guy, even though the Jets got a pretty good haul for him, nobody thought they'd get two number ones, but now you've set a roadmap for every player that wants to get out of every situation. So he got exactly what he wanted. Now, he didn't go to Dallas and he didn't go to Baltimore, but he certainly did go to a team that has a chance to win a Super Bowl. So the player did indeed win. And the Jets have to wait a couple of years to see if they win. And those draft picks are not going to be high draft picks because Seattle's always a pretty good team. So it's going to be in the 20s. So I don't think the fans really feel good about losing Jamal Adams. In fact, the Jets traded their best player.
Well, they did trade their best player, and I guess to that end, what the Jets got back was potential, and unfortunately, I think Jet fans are so used to saying, we'll find a way to screw it up, correct?
That's always been the case, and they usually have been proven right, and it's just strange. If you look, I think they've traded five of their last six number one picks. I mean, if a team wants to build something, you eventually and essentially have to hold on to your best players. And that has not been the case. And maybe they haven't drafted that well. So maybe we look at their number one picks and say, well, they traded them. Well, maybe they just weren't good enough. So it's not fair to blame Joe Douglas for this. And, you know, we felt that this trade was maybe a reaction to what Jamal said. But then we find out that over the last 2 weeks, they had been, you know, working a deal together with Seattle. So all along, they planned to trade him. And you know, if you want to look at it from another angle, the Jets aren't going to win the Super Bowl this year anyway. They're probably not going to win it next year. So maybe they just felt, why are we going to pay Jamal Adams all this money? And if we don't pay him the money, although they had the right not to for the next 2 years, you've got a situation where you have a malcontent that could maybe poison the clubhouse.
Well, what's interesting about that is we're talking to Michael Kay, Yankees play-by-play on Yes Network, and does the Michael Kay Show on ESPN New York 98.7 FM, is that this is not only something that the Jets have done a lot of in getting rid of first-round picks, but it's also something that Adam Gase, the head coach, has done at a different stop in Miami. He was more than happy on more than one occasion, Michael, to find someone who he didn't like or didn't like the way they're doing and just move them along instead of trying to work out a situation. We saw that with Jay Ajayi and several other players in Miami. So it's not just the thing that the Jets have done. This is clearly a pattern of behavior by their current head coach in his other stops in his career.
And if it works out, Trey, then it's okay. If Bill Belichick does it, it's okay, because you pretty much paint it as, well, we're building the right culture. We don't want certain players right here that might poison things. But so far it has not worked out for Adam. And I think that had to be a little bit of a sting for Adam Gase when Jamal Adams said the things that he said. He can't get us to the promised land. But then there are guys like Frank Gore who come out and say, you know what, I love Adam Gase. He's unbelievable. That's why I came here. So, winning is the great deodorant. So either he wins and this looks like a win for him, or he loses. He's not around to discuss it anymore. Probably doesn't get a third chance.
Fair or unfair, is Adam Gase on the hot seat this year?
I don't think he should be, Mike, but, you know, I think sports have changed right in front of our eyes. And, guys don't even complete second years. We saw it happen with the Giants. So, two in a row. You know, Ben McAdoo didn't complete a second year. Pat Shurmur did. I just think that sports are different now. 4 or 5, 6 year plans, they don't work anymore. So, the Jet fans have not been to the playoffs in forever. And I don't think they're going to make the playoffs again. And I wonder. I think, Mike, that the whole season might be judged on how Sam Darnold progresses. If he looks like he takes a quantum leap forward, then I think that Adam Gase is good, even if the team doesn't make the playoffs. But I'd say his seat is incredibly warm. I don't know if it's hot.
And that relationship will be the thing we monitor most closely going forward. Michael Kay with us, hosting the Michael Kay Show on ESPN New York 98.7. Michael, one of the other things in the good news department we saw over the weekend was the start from the Yankees. Certainly Garrett Cole's first appearance in a Yankee uniform went about as well as you could have expected. And Giancarlo Stanton rebounding strong in the early going here. What had you most excited coming off of the opening weekend for Major League Baseball, specifically for the Pinstripes?
I'll tell you what, Mike, you look at them and they're just a really, really good team. You know, I was watching them over the weekend and I said, gee, it's unfortunate now we're not going to see them over 162 games, because they are that good. They're built for a long season. They're built for the 60-game season. And the only thing that can derail them is injuries or COVID-19 positive tests. And I think that's the concern with most teams in baseball right now. But the Yankees are stacked. Even if they lose a starter, they've got guys like Michael King. They've got guys like Clark Schmidt, Jonathan Loaisiga. They can absorb anything. I think the one position that they don't have enough depth at is probably shortstop. And Gleyber Torres has a big game yesterday. Gets his first hit. Gets a home run. And the bottom line is, otherwise, everybody else on that team is an outstanding player. I mean, they just have good players up and down the organization, and I'd be surprised if this team is not in the World Series. But the way the playoffs are set up now, you know, it's a best of three at the beginning. Even the best team could lose a best of three. That's a little scary, but take that out of the equation. The Yankees are pretty darn good. The Yankees and the Dodgers look great.
Yeah, there's a reason they came in as the betting favorites to this, and we'll see how that plays out going forward. So, Michael, this is all very weird this baseball season. The short run-up, which has led to a spate of arm injuries. We hear Justin Verlander, you know, Clayton Kershaw missed because of a back. You have Kluber going out. There's so many guys right away that are getting dinged up. Is that because we just went so fast to get from trying to get spring training again and get into the season? Because it certainly seems like a lot of these pitchers' arms are falling victim to that.
And a lot of people predicted it, Trey. I'm telling you, and I think it's going to be a continuing concern. 3 weeks is not enough to get ready, and all the pitchers were throwing on their own. Throwing in the backyard off a slope is not the same thing as pitching to batters, and I think these guys amped up and ramped up too quickly. You just saw some guys in the first time they pitched in inter-squad games are throwing 97, 98 miles an hour. To me, that is a recipe for disaster. I remember former Yankee manager Buck Showalter told me before the season, he said, when you're putting together what's going to happen now, the inclination is to really rush. He said you have to go against your inclination and take it even slower. And if your starters have to go 3 innings in the first couple of starts, then that's what you have to do. He said, because if you ramp it up and rush it, then injuries are going to happen. And I think that's what we're seeing, and I think that's what we'll continue to see, especially with pitchers. It's such a fragile situation right now with pitchers, and you're going to see a lot of great pitchers get hurt, unfortunately, and that's not good for the game.
Michael Kay joining us here on Golic and Wingo, and we're talking about injuries. We're talking about the other thing that can derail a team or a season, and this just in from Jeff Passan. Eight more players and two coaches with the Miami Marlins have tested positive for COVID-19 as an outbreak has spread throughout their clubhouse and brought the total of cases in recent days to at least 14, sources familiar with the situation tell both Jeff Passan and our Jesse Rogers. So from that side of it, Michael, I mean, what one thing we never have gotten is what number triggers a team shutting down or possibly the sport shutting down. I would have to imagine for the Marlins, we got to be right there as far as a team shutting down. What effect do you think this has, not only with them, but throughout?
Well, I think this puts a shudder throughout Major League Baseball because this is the great concern. And, you know, when you're not in a bubble and you're traveling, you're inviting this sort of thing. And I know a lot of teams that I spoke to were concerned about trips into Texas and into Florida and into California, all areas that have had spikes right now. And the Marlins come from Florida. And go to Philadelphia, it's scary. I mean, you've got to be right up against that number, Mike, about, you know, postponing games right now. And that's my biggest concern. That is the only thing that could derail this sport right now. I think the NBA and the NHL went about it the right way. And baseball obviously had the right thought at the beginning when they said about, you know, maybe we should do the quarantine and a bubble in Arizona. Arizona ended up being a hot spot as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, Florida's a hot spot, and it looks like the NBA is doing okay with all of their tests. So this is frightening right now. It really is. Here's my one concern with all this, and nobody has an answer for me. So three guys tested positive on the Marlins, and they played yesterday when they had tests before the game. Either you have rapid return on the test, I mean really rapid, that day, or they don't matter. So you played a game against the Phillies. You had a chance of infecting the Phillies by playing them. And now all these other people have tested positive because there's just not a quick enough turnaround in the test. Either that gets fixed or it's going to be very difficult to have baseball. If you're going to have to wait 2 or 3 days for a test back, then while you're waiting 2 or 3 days, more infections could happen and isolation's not going to happen. And I don't know why that has not been solved. I do not know why they are not insisting on having turnarounds on the test of less than a day so you cannot play a game like yesterday and maybe you could stop the spread quicker.
The Reds had an infielder test positive the day after playing in a game, too. That's already popped up, unfortunately, a couple of times. And you mentioned postponement. Jeff Passan followed up on that tweet with another one. The Marlins home opener against the Baltimore Orioles tonight has been canceled, sources tell ESPN, as the team remains in Philadelphia and continues to undergo testing. So we have now seen what we all expected, unfortunately, at some point to happen, Michael, with these sports outside of the bubble is delays, forfeitures, or cancellations, however you're going to call it on this. I'm curious, as we look at this, because you mentioned the NHL, the NBA and all this, the WNBA, these teams and leagues that have done this inside the bubble have had some early success. How much pause does this give you about what we're ready to embark on with the NFL, which is even more bodies in a situation outside of a bubble?
Well, we've had doctors on my show in New York, guys, and they have come out and said, of all the sports, the one thing that they can't see happening is the NFL. I mean, the way the players are on top of each other, there's so many players, they're so closely bunched together, they just don't know how you're going to stop the spread in the NFL. So I think that has to give you pause. It really does. And again, the one thing that works is a bubble. And I look at the NBA, and I don't want to say the NBA is the perfect situation because that's a bubble with a lot of holes in it. A bubble with a lot of holes in it is not a bubble. But if you had a real bubble and guys were tested all the time, you could get this done. Now, with Major League Baseball and 30 teams, it is a huge endeavor. It would be a gigantic endeavor in football. I don't know how football would do a bubble. I'm not certain how they would do it. But as long as you're going to travel and as long as you're going to let players go out into their communities and go to restaurants, go back to their families, you are inviting other areas of infection. So I don't want to be the doom and gloom guy because I've got to be honest with you. This weekend in baseball has been great. The games have been fun. They've been entertaining. It's everything you want. But Dr. Fauci said this a long time ago, the virus will decide if we go on and play these games. And right now the virus is deciding the Marlins are not going to play the game tonight. And you wonder what kind of ramifications that has for every other team.
It just feels like this might be the tip of the iceberg. Wow. Michael, as always, we appreciate your time. Be well, be safe, and we'll be listening this afternoon, my friend. Thank you.
And, guys, I just want to say thank you for everything that you've done. I'm going to miss you guys. I obviously will see you around, but Mike Golic Sr. especially, you've been there so long, and you've been a part of my mornings, and I want to thank you for how you've always treated me so kindly.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, appreciate buddy. It very
appreciate
much,
that.
Man.
That's really nice of you.
Yeah, we'll definitely be talking to you.
Golic.
Makes me want to vomit and then punch you square in the face.
And Wingo.
Oh, he's saucy today.
Insider extraordinaire Jeff Passan. Jeff, what more can you tell us about a developing horrible story, not only for the Marlins and Major League Baseball, but for all sports trying to get going here?
Yeah, Trey, this is a really difficult situation right now, and I'd love to say that it was not to be expected, but when you are traveling in the middle of a pandemic, when you are going from city to city, I'm not going to say that this is an inevitability, but something like this was bound to happen. And you had hoped that with the testing and that with social distancing and that with mask wearing, you could contain something like this. But yesterday, when it was reported that four Marlins players had tested positive within the previous 48 hours for coronavirus, there was a distinct concern that that number was going to mushroom. And it has today 12 players positive, two coaches, that is 14 total. Their game, home opener tonight against the Baltimore Orioles, has been canceled. And honestly, the season, their season, Major League Baseball at this point, there are big questions that did not exist 24 hours ago.
Our own Carl Ravitch tweeted out, under the agreement, Major League Commissioner Rob Manfred has the power to suspend or cancel the season if a team or teams suffer an outbreak and competitive integrity is compromised. Is that realistically on the table as we're talking about it here and now today, Jeff?
Yeah, it absolutely is on the table. The question for Rob Manfred now is, what lengths are you willing to go to continue the season? To remember all the time that they have spent in training camp, getting ready for this season, the huge unveiling of the season with opening day just this past week, and to end it right here, just days into the season, would be an absolute gut shot for the sport. And I think that the league is going to do everything it can to play. But if you're the Marlins and you're missing 12 of your 30 players, that's 40% of the roster. What's the competitive integrity look like there? Now, I really do wonder, and this, you know, the context here matters. I really do wonder if this is different, if it's the New York Yankees or the Houston Astros or the Los Angeles Dodgers, or even a smaller market team that is competitive. Does the fact that the Marlins were not planning on being one of the best teams this year, and probably were going to be pretty well below 500 even before this, make the competitive integrity argument in favor of continuing the season? I know that's a macabre thing to think about, but I think that's going to be part of the calculus here when Major League Baseball determines how it goes forward with this.
And also, that said, these games have been canceled, not postponed. Is that what's happening here? Because of the shortened season, these games cannot be made up?
You know, I don't know. I think we're talking semantics right there, honestly. I don't know if it's a postponement or a pure cancellation. I would assume they're going to try to make up the game if at some point this continues. But as of right now, all I know is they are not playing in Miami tonight, because we have to recognize what the protocol calls for. The protocol in this case says that when you test positive on the road, you must remain in that city, meaning at least 12 Miami Marlins players and at least two coaches are going to be in the city of Philadelphia until they test negative twice. Now, for some people, that may be a matter of days. For some, that may be a matter of weeks. I know of a player who tested positive for over a month, even though he was asymptomatic, just continued to test positive. And that is the part where the competitive integrity of the season really is jeopardized.
So Jeff, with that in mind, I have to ask, if these Marlins players tested positive before the game yesterday, why did they play yesterday?
Good question, Trey.
I mean,
I think that the players wanted to play, and I think that Major League Baseball didn't want to set off any alarms with just four players, but the entire Philadelphia Phillies roster was exposed. You know, the Atlanta Braves, who they played in exhibition games earlier this week, could have theoretically contracted it. And You know, we've seen two players there, Travis Darno and Tyler Flowers. They're two catchers. I'm not sure if they're actually on the injured list or not playing games, but no reason has been given, which tends to mean, in this case, COVID. It's something, if you want to understand the way that this thing mushrooms, we wouldn't be thinking of the New York Yankees being involved in this at all, guys, because they've been nowhere near any of the teams involved. They're supposed to play a game in Philadelphia today. Do you think the Yankees want to go into that visiting clubhouse right now where 12 Marlins players, I guess eight Marlins players yesterday were at the ballpark, and I believe it was 12, maybe 11 who had been there in recent days who had tested positive? There is no way that the Yankees are going to want to play there tonight. So it's not just the Orioles and Marlins game that's in peril. It's the Yankees and Phillies, too.
Jeff, I'm curious, as we sit here now, how much regret has to be going on in Major League Baseball's head office right now about not making a stronger pursuit of one of the bubble models that were talked about before the season?
Well, I am intimately familiar with that because I don't know if you recall in this hellscape of the year, but I broke the story about MLB potentially pursuing a bubble model. This was back in April, and I was saying in the story that, you know, this could happen as soon as May. And it was amazing the fallout that happened almost instantaneously among players saying there is no way that we are going to play in a bubble. There is no way we are going to go away from our friends and our families for 5 months to live in the greater Phoenix area. And of course, Phoenix has turned out to be, one of the hot spots in recent months. And so it may not have worked had they gone that route. But yeah, I mean, of course, a bubble scenario, as the NBA has shown, is ideal. Major League Baseball just operates on such a different scale, guys, than the NBA does. The NBA has the ability, because of smaller rosters and because they don't need as many backup players, to go and live at Disney World. Major League Baseball had no ability to do that. And there was no great bubble scenario, anything would have been better than traveling around the country, certainly.
So at this point, are we waiting for a word from the league office? What do we think is next here?
Yeah, I think at this point we got to hear from the Marlins. We got to hear from Major League Baseball. And I think Rob Manfred needs to come out and make a statement today talking about the viability of this season and how they continue to proceed or whether they continue to proceed, because that's the question on everyone's mind right now. Can baseball happen in 2020 after an outbreak like this?
And Jeff, whether it's fair or unfair, a lot of people are going to say, okay, it's the Marlins. We understand that. And I guess what I'm asking is, would the perception of this be treated differently if it was a team besides the Marlins, or does the outbreak itself dictate what's going to happen here?
Yeah, I mean, the Marlins are a joke and all that. But the reality is there are 30 human beings on that roster. There's the same size coaching staff, training staff, public relations staff, front office. They are all human beings like every other team. So no matter what uniform they are wearing, it had better be treated equally. Or otherwise, the sport just simply isn't doing things right. And I understand that there is always going to be that preferential treatment. Like if the Yankees test positive, it is an infinitely larger story. But in truth, in reality, it is the same. We are dealing with people here. We are dealing with a pandemic here, and the combination of those two winds up being really, really bad.
Just wow. Devastating news, kind of a gut punch on what had been a pretty great sports weekend in a lot of ways. Jeff, we appreciate the time this morning and the job you're doing covering all of this. Best of luck, man, and hopefully at some point we'll get some decent news here.
I was going to say, guys, I am sorry to be Debbie Downer here. I just feel like we need a sound effect. Because that's what it feels like right now.
The reality is the reality, yeah. And there's no way escaping this, even though some people try.
Yeah.
Jeff, we appreciate your time. Great job this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, fellas.
This has been the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or just ask your smart speaker to play Golic and Wingo. Plus, you can check the guys out live weekday mornings from 6 to 10 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN News.